Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your Calls One Planet series. A new study based on 20 years of research reveals disturbing information about why 20% of adult California sea lions are dying from cancer. Scientists at the Marine Mammal Center, the world's largest marine mammal hospital, have found that viral-caused cancer is significantly increased by sea lions' exposure to toxins in the environment, including DDT. Since cancer in sea lions was first discovered at the center in 1979, between 18 and 23% of adult sea lions admitted to the center's hospital have died of the fatal disease, the highest prevalence for a single type of cancer in any mammal, including humans. The study, which was published in Frontiers in Marine Science, concluded that efforts to prevent ecosystem contamination with pollutants must improve in order to prevent virally caused cancer development in wildlife and humans. Dr. Parik Daignan, chief pathologist at the Marine Mammal Center, is co-author of the study. Dr. Daignan's research focuses on diseases that impact marine mammals of the West Coast. The Marine Mammal Center advances global ocean conservation through marine mammal rescue and rehabilitation, scientific research, and education. Since 1975, the center has rescued more than 24,000 marine mammals along 600 miles of California coastline and the Big Island of Hawaii. The number of animals they rescue varies by season and year, but they've seen an ongoing increase since they began their work four decades ago. The Marine Mammal Center is based in Sausalito, California, and you can visit marinemammalcenter.org to find out when they're going to reopen again, and you can visit and take tours. It's really an incredible place. Dr. Daignan, thank you so much for your work, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much, Rose. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Well, it's a real pleasure to have you. You all do such incredible work. I just have a basic question first off. I read on your website that the California sea lion population is growing steadily. The center says there are 238,000 alive today. So I take it that's good news?
Yeah, that's correct. So they have been doing quite well since persecution stopped with the Marine Mammal Protection Act of 1972. So they've been growing steadily. They have some issues with genetic bottlenecking, as in other species were. Their numbers have been reduced greatly, like northern elephant seals, for example. But in general, sea lion is doing quite well. They are faced with numerous problems, though, and cancer is just one of a whole range of things that they're faced with.
What are some of the other problems they're facing?
You've probably heard of red tide toxins or algal toxins. They're natural toxins that are produced by dinoflagellate algae in the ocean. And historically, these have been produced at relatively low levels and often in the warmer months in summer. Monterey Bay was an area where they were most prevalent, and the blooms would last for a few weeks. But the algae produce a toxin that's like a neurotoxin, and it affects not just marine mammals, but also seabirds and fish. But it gets into sea lions and other marine mammals through fish like anchovies. And when they get enough of this toxin, it causes neurological disease equivalent to epilepsy in people. And it also causes cardiac disease that can result in cardiac failure. But over the last two decades, we've seen increasingly large blooms and blooms that persist for longer. And in one of the recent years, 2015, when we had that blob anomaly happened in the North Pacific. The bloom started around Central California and extended all the way to Alaska, killing tens of thousands of marine mammals and birds over a number of months. So this is something we see every year now, and not just in summer months. We can see it almost in any season. So that's a big problem. And aside from that, we see lots of other diseases, bacterial diseases, viral infections. There's also human interaction problems, and then the sea lion cancer. So lots of different issues.
Before we dive in and talk about the cancer, because it's really just a devastating story and crisis, really, let's talk just a little bit about sea lions. As your website says, California sea lions are known for their intelligence, playfulness, noisy barking. Their fur color ranges from chocolate brown seen in males to a lighter golden brown seen in females. The males reach up to 600 to 850 pounds, which is amazing, and 7 feet in length. The females grow to 200 to 250 pounds and up to 6 feet in length. What else should we know about sea lions?
Well, they're probably the most familiar pinniped. That's the group of animals, mammals, that have these fin-like flippers, like all the harbor seals, elephant seals, sea lions, fur seals. They're all pinnipeds. But the California sea lion is the one that most people would be familiar with from displays in zoos and aquaria, because, as you said, they're very gregarious, they're noisy, they're fun, they like to play, they're easily trained, very intelligent. And so most people, that's the seal they're familiar with. Lucille, the mascot for the Giants, is a sea lion. So, you know, most people are familiar with the California sea lion.
What is the significance of sea lions for the marine ecosystem?
Well, they're an apex predator on the West Coast, and it's not just California. Their main breeding center of concentration is around the Channel Islands in Southern California. And that's the area of problem now with the pollution. But they extend from Mexico right through California, and in summer months, in our non-breeding months, they can extend right up into southern Canada. So they have quite a wide range on the West Coast, and in that part of their range, they are one of the top predators in the coastal ecosystem. So the near shore coastal ecosystem, they're a top predator.
Newborn California sea lions weigh between 13 and 20 pounds and stay with their mothers for about a year as they nurse and learn important survival skills like how to swim and find their own food. And it was so interesting to learn that they recognize their pups in crowded areas through smell and vocalizations, because those of us who've been lucky enough to see a lot of sea lions, at times there could be a lot of them. And so you have to wonder, how do the moms recognize their babies?
Yeah, sound is a particularly important thing. And each individual pup has its own signature call that the mother will recognize, and vice versa. And when you work with sea lions in the field and you're observing how they interact, because when the mother has her pup, she'll stay with the pup for about a week full time, you know, nursing, but then she has to go back to sea to feed herself, and will make foraging trips for varying lengths of time, 2 or 3, 4 or 5 days maybe, come back, and in that big crowd at rookery, she'll be able to go straight to where her pup is. And equally, when the pups get a little bit older and they're in puppy creches and playing with other pups, as soon as they hear the mother calling, you'll see them running from wherever they are to get to where the mother is. So they both recognize their calls.
And they feed on squid, octopus, and small schooling fish like herring, anchovies, and sardines.
Yes. Of all of the pinnipeds, they're probably the biggest opportunists. So they'll feed on whatever's around, whatever's easy to catch, and they have quite a varied diet.
And this is not nice to think about, but this is the wild and the food chain, everybody's in it. In turn, sea lions are preyed upon by orcas and great white sharks.
Yes, that's correct. And we see a lot of our patients presenting at the Marine Mammal Center have been victims of shark attacks that haven't fatally killed them, but have caused significant damage. And often the damage is so severe that they end up having to be euthanized on humane grounds. So it is a big deal. But it is also for southern sea otters, where the shark attack is a major cause of mortality.
Hmm. Tell us more about the Marine Mammal Center and the rehabilitation that you all do. As I said in the introduction, the number of animals you all rescue varies by season and year, but you've seen an ongoing increase since you began this work 4 decades ago.
Yes, that's correct. Well, when the center started about in the mid-70s, it was a pretty small operation. But since then, and even since I joined the center full-time in June 2016, the number of staff we have and the number of volunteers has also increased dramatically. And we now have around 100 full-time staff employed at the center. So our ability to respond has increased greatly. And we cover 600 miles of coast. And you mentioned we also have a satellite hospital in on the Great Island of Hawaii that deals just with monk seals. But in California, we have satellites at Monterey Bay and at San Luis Obispo. And between those and our main hospital, Sausalito, and also our northern range that extends up into Humboldt County, we cover a lot of coast, and we have a lot of people on the ground, a lot of hundreds of volunteers, and we rely very heavily on the public to notify us about animals in distress. So our response has improved, but also, as if we talked about the sea lion, their numbers have increased, their population has increased over that 40 years. And the same for Guadalupe fur seals, which are a threatened endangered species that now are restricted to breeding on certain islands in northern Mexico. But their range used to include California and still does for non-breeding animals, but their numbers have increased dramatically in the last 20 years. So a lot of species that were heavily impacted by adverse human activity, you know, in the early years of the 20th century are now rebounding, and means our caseload increases. Same applies for the whales and dolphins. You probably heard a little bit about the number of gray whales we've been responding to in the last 2 months. Well, the gray whale population has also rebounded from the years of whale hunting, and we do see more of those.
Hmm. You have a 24-hour rescue hotline, and on your website, you have a little section on all of your patients. And so here's just one example. California sea lion sea dog was spotted not looking like a healthy young sea lion should. He was brought to the hospital where veterinarians determined that he was showing signs of domoic acid toxicity, which is a potentially deadly neurotoxin and accumulates in small fish like sardines and anchovies. So when we talk about the food chain, every single animal in the food chain is just so important to the animal that eats it. And then again, at the very top, you've got the humans that also eat these animals.
That's correct. And we often talk about marine mammals as being sentinels in the ocean for us, because sea lions, as you said, are top predators. The fish, not just anchovies, but larger fish and similar fish and invertebrates to what we eat as seafood. And so whatever they're exposed to through the food chain, we are too, albeit maybe in lower doses, because we eat less seafood per pound of our body weight than a sea lion would, but still we're exposed to the same chemicals and the same pathogens that sea lions may be exposed to.
Today, we are speaking with Dr. Parik Daignan, chief pathologist at the Marine Mammal Center. He and a team of scientists found that cancer rates among adult California sea lions is significantly increased by their exposure to toxins in the environment, including DDT. The 2020 study, a result of over 20 years of research, highlighted how the exposure to environmental contaminants can fast-track the likelihood of California sea lions developing virally caused cancer. And this is a pre-taped One Planet series, so unfortunately we cannot take your calls or your comments, but we'll definitely have Dr. Daignan on a future show so we can do that. So Dr. Daignan, let's talk about this report. It's the result of over 20 years of research. You and your team examined nearly 400 California sea lion patients by the Marine Mammal Center. Talk about how you all conducted your research.
So this study started because cancer was first noted in sea lions in the 1980s. And the first publication in the late 1990s was a summation of that first 10 years of necropsy data from the center. And at that point in time, it was found out that approximately 15% or so of adult sea lions who presented to our hospital for various reasons had cancer. And for many of them, it was the reason they stranded and it was the reason that they died. So that sparked a lot of inquiry then as to why this should be, because that's an extremely high rate of cancer in a free-living marine animal of any kind, not just a marine mammal. And the cancer that was discovered, it was a particular cancer. It was of the reproductive tract. And the vast majority of sea lions with cancer, that is the kind of cancer they have. They will get other kinds of cancer just like people do, but the vast majority that we see with fatal cancer is this one type of cancer. So a prevalence of initially 15 or so percent was extremely high. But when we started doing more detailed studies, so looking at the tissue level presence or absence of cancer in all adult sea lions, male and female, we found that the cancer is present at a microscopic level in more than just that original 15%. So it brought the prevalence up to around 25%. So that is extremely high. And that then begs the question, what is behind that? What is the reason for that?
Before we answer that question, under the section, How Do Sea Lions Get Cancer? It says cancer development is a multi-step process during which damage to the genetic material of cells, DNA, arises from the interaction between a number of factors. Can you talk more about that?
Yeah, so that's sort of a general statement for any kind of cancer. So our DNA encodes our genes and the proteins that are made from that encryption. So if something goes wrong with that, it can lead to abnormalities in growth. So unregulated growth or failure of cells to respond to normal signals or failure of cells to die when they should die. So cell growth just gets out of whack. And if cells become immortal like that, they can then spread locally, or if they are a particular kind of cancer, they can get into blood vessels or lymphatic vessels and spread around the body, and we call that metastasis. And at that stage, if it's spread around the body and gets into vital organs, it can be fatal. So how does the DNA get damaged to allow it to result in these cells that no longer respond to normal regulation? Well, there's different things can happen. The DNA could be damaged by ultraviolet light. So an example of that would be melanoma in the skin, so that your skin cells are damaged by UV light, and that damages the DNA, and then melanoma develops. Or it could be chemicals like these ones we're talking about with the sea lions. It could be just some genetic mutation that happens spontaneously. So there's any number of reasons that it can happen. So there's generally a primary insult or injury to the DNA, and then often a second thing will happen or be present that will promote the development of the cancer. So often you will need two things, an initial insult and something then to promote the development of the cancer and the spread of the cancer.
The report also says that California sea lions are a model for studying this kind of cancer. The research the center conducts after the death of a sea lion with cancer is invaluable, as this kind of work is just not possible with humans. So that's really important.
It is really important, and it's something we've been trying to promote for a number of years now, because, as I said, the prevalence of this cancer is extremely high. It's a single kind of cancer that allows the opportunity to study a large number of animals with it and with different presentations of it, from very early stages of development of the cancer right through to fatal metastatic cancer. And as I said, we see at least 20 cases of this every year, often more than that. And we get these animals in alive because they present sick, ill, and that allows the opportunity to collect blood samples, to do imaging, to collect various samples that can then be used to study the development of the cancer further. And because of the similarities between this cancer and cervical cancer in women, it's very similar in where it starts in the body, how it metastasizes, and the association with a virus. It's an ideal model for studying that particular cancer, because there is no other animal model for this. There's no other species that has a spontaneous cancer like that anywhere, lab animal model or any other kind of model. So if we want to learn more about how cervical cancer develops in women and becomes metastatic, the sea lion presents an excellent example of how we could do this.
It was interesting to learn in a Los Angeles Times piece that you previously studied sea lions in New Zealand, which have minuscule amounts of DDT compared to with what you've seen in California.
Yes. So when I was a professor at Massey University in New Zealand, we had a sea lion health program with the endangered New Zealand sea lion on the Auckland Islands. So for about 9 years while I was there, we had an intensive health monitoring program. And in all of that time when I was there, I never saw any cases of cancer at all. So we had other causes of mortality, of course, but we didn't see any cancer. And one of the big differences is, well, two differences, obviously, are that they didn't have the high levels of pollutants that we see here in California, but they also didn't have the particular herpes virus that the California sea lion has here. And they're the two key elements in the sea lion cancer in California is this herpes virus and the high levels of pollutants.
What causes the herpes virus?
So the herpes virus is basically an endemic virus of the sea lion. All species, or most species of mammals and birds, have herpes viruses, and there's quite a number of them in people. Most of them are innocuous. They don't really cause any problems at all. But in humans, there's one particular one, human herpes virus 8, and that one is associated with a kind of cancer in people called Kaposi sarcoma. And that came to a prominence in the 1980s with the AIDS epidemic, because people who were immunosuppressed, this herpes virus became activated. And because it has oncogenes or cancer-causing genes in its genome, it caused the Kaposi sarcoma, which could be fatal. Now, what our researchers at the Marine Mammal Center have found is that the herpes virus that's most common in the sea lion, and they call it Otorhine herpes virus 1, has very similar oncogenes in it. And that makes it unique because herpes viruses, as I said, are common in other, we have them in harbor seals, we have them in northern elephant seals and fur seals, but they don't have the oncogenes. So having the oncogenes gives this particular sea lion herpes virus the ability to initiate cancer. So I was just going to say the combination of that with the pollutants is what allows cancer to develop.
Well, we're going to take a quick break. Today, we're joined by Dr. Parik Daignan, chief pathologist at the Marine Mammal Center in Sausalito, California. He and a team of scientists from the center found that cancer rates among adult California sea lions is significantly increased by their exposure to toxins in the environment, including DDT. The 2020 study, a result of over 20 years of research, highlighted how the exposure to environmental contaminants can fast-track the likelihood of California sea lions developing virally caused cancers, which is also an alarming implication for human health. And you can find more information about the study at yourcallradio.org. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, we are talking about a new study based on 20 years of research revealing disturbing information about why 20% of adult California sea lions are dying from cancer. And we're talking about it with Dr. Parik Daignan, chief pathologist at the Marine Mammal Center, which is located in Sausalito, California. They advance global ocean conservation through marine mammal rescue and rehabilitation, scientific research, and education. Dr. Daignan, before the break, we were talking about the herpes virus. Let's now talk about what we're learning about DDT. And this is so, so important. Last October, the Los Angeles Times reporter, Rosanna Shaw, exposed the discovery of more than 500,000 DDT barrels that were dumped off the coast of Southern California near Catalina Island from the 1940s to the 80s. And according to the piece, one company, Montrose, caused a devastating environmental crisis. We've done a couple of shows with Rosanna Shaw, and you and other marine mammal first responders were quoted in one of her follow-up pieces called Sea Lions Are Dying from a Mysterious Cancer, The Culprits, Herpes, and DDT. Can you talk about the significance of this report?
Yes, it's the result of groundbreaking research by a number of scientists in Southern California who followed up on those early leads about dumping of DDT off the Channel Islands. And earlier I mentioned that the Channel Islands in Southern California are really the exclusive breeding area for the whole species. So it's extremely important. I also mentioned that in their normal breeding cycle that when the female gives birth to our pup, she'll spend the first week or so in close attendance with the pup, but then she has to go foraging locally to get supplies for herself and to continue making milk for the pup. So all of that local foraging she's doing is in this area that's heavily contaminated with the DDT. So the fish she's eating is loaded with DDT. It gets into her fat because it's a fat-soluble chemical. From the fat, it gets mobilized into her liver and into her milk and then directly into the pup. So not only are the pups getting DDT while they're in utero, but even after they're born, by drinking the milk, they're still getting very high doses of DDT from the mothers.
In the piece, you said that even though some of these pollutants that you're finding in the blubber have been out of use for years, like DDT, these cancer-causing elements remain in the environment for a very long time and wreak havoc on opportunistic coastal feeders like sea lions.
That's correct. And that the general category for all of these chemicals is persistent organic pollutants, or POPs. And that just tells you in the name that these things persist. They're not easily broken down, or if they break down in time, it's very slowly. And even the degradation products are often just as toxic as the original products. So they are legacy chemicals. They will be around for many, many, many years to come.
So we don't know how long these animals will be exposed to these chemicals.
That's correct. And the early attempts to deal with there are two dumping sites off of the southern coast of California that were mentioned in the article. One is directly off the coast because the chemicals were dumped in the sewage system. And then they were also dumped in barrels, sealed barrels or containers offshore off of Catalina Island. Now, both of those sites, dumping sites, have approximately the same amount of DDT dumped in them, which is a huge amount. But they tried to mitigate the dump site that's immediately off the coast by covering it with clean sand. And early results from that, from testing, show that maybe they had mitigated some of the problem, but more recent studies have shown that they haven't, that the DDT is still there and still available, still bioavailable in the sediment to invertebrates and then on up into fish and right through the food chain.
And we'll talk about the food chain in a minute. Do you know how the cancer affects the sea lions? Do we know if they're in pain as a result?
Oh, yes. We have patients who present. It all depends on exactly how it metastasizes or spreads in the body. So each individual seems to be somewhat different from the next one. But for many individuals, the cancer spreads from the reproductive tract into the local lymph nodes. And the lymph nodes closest to the reproductive tract are the lymph nodes that sit along the lumbar spine. And if they become involved and get enlarged, they often block off the ureters that drain the kidneys, and in which case the urine backs up into the kidneys and causes the kidneys to fail. So they will present in renal failure. And those animals are extremely sick, lethargic, unresponsive, and clearly in pain, clearly in abdominal pain. So that's a very common presentation.
How do you treat the cancer?
Well, luckily, our clinicians now are so familiar with it that they can diagnose it pretty much straight away. As soon as the animal presents, they will do an ultrasound of the abdominal cavity. And if they find the large masses of tumor in there, they know that there's really no treatment for it. There's no surgical option. There's no medical option. And euthanasia on a humane grounds is really the only course.
Well, that must be so hard for the vets and everyone at the center.
It is. It's very difficult because most of these animals are that we see, most of our cases are female. It does occur in male animals. We don't tend to see them so often. Maybe they when they're ill, they go off and they don't tend to strand on a beach where they're rescued. But we've seen females as young as just becoming mature. They haven't even had a pup yet, up to, you know, fully mature individuals. So it's all ages of females in that older age class. So it's very sad.
So between 18 and 23% of adult sea lions admitted to the Marine Mammal Center's hospital have died of cancer. Do you expect these numbers will go up in the coming years?
Well, that's one thing we found, Rose, that hasn't changed very much. Hmm. We've now published three studies, each one a 10-year period, starting from the late 70s and through until 2015. And in each of those studies, the prevalence didn't really vary very much at all. It stayed around the same. The only thing that changed or elevated our prevalence a little bit was, as I mentioned, we started doing more microscopic studies looking for very early cancer, and that added a few percentage to our prevalence, made it up to around 25% having cancer, but not necessarily fatal cancer at that time. So it hasn't really changed, and that's probably because the other factors associated with it haven't changed. The virus has been around for a long time, and these chemicals, as we know, have been around since post-World War II, and they're persistent. So the animals are, you know, consistently exposed to them over recent decades. So that hasn't changed.
It's so interesting to learn that cancer is actually rare in wild animals. We found a study about beluga whales, the only similar example of widespread cancer that has been scientifically documented in sea mammals seems to be in a beluga whale population in the St. Lawrence Estuary in Canada. The river had been contaminated by hydrocarbons, or H's, produced by local aluminum smelters. The cancer was identified in 27% of the adult whales that were found dead and examined. But after the pollution went down, the cancer went away. And so you just have to wonder, like, why is it taking so long for this DDT to be cleaned up in California?
Yes, I'm glad you mentioned that, because the beluga example of cancer in marine mammals has always been mentioned as being sort of a key example. But you rightly pointed out there that once they associated the cancer with the presence of these PAH chemicals that were direct result of contamination from the aluminum smelters, once they stopped allowing them to release those chemicals into the St. Lawrence and the Great Lakes, the prevalence of cancer has decreased. And in fact, they have not diagnosed a case of cancer in a beluga since 2004. Hmm. So this is something from the past, even though it's still mentioned as being a high prevalence of cancer in belugas. It all happened in belugas that are peaked in belugas that were born in the 1940s and 1950s. And then subsequent to that, no animal that was born since 1971 has had cancer, and they haven't diagnosed it at all since 2004. So if the problem can be the source of the cancer can be got rid of, in that case, the BAH chemicals, then you can see a turnaround in the prevalence and a decrease. And unfortunately, the magnitude of the problem here in California is such that even though we've known about these chemicals for a long time and where they're coming from, nothing has really been done to get rid of them or to mitigate the problem.
Right. Well, so we know how the DDT is affecting sea lions. What about other animals? You also take care of sea otters, for example. How is DDT affecting the lives of other marine animals?
Well, we know that DDT and those related organochlorine chemicals are present in basically in all marine mammals on our coast. One of the things that's different, though, for the sea lion is that that herpes virus that I mentioned that probably initiates the cancer, and then the DDT and the organochlorines help it to spread around the body. Now, the other marine mammals we deal with don't have a similar virus. So even though they have the chemical in them, they don't have the ability to develop the cancer the same way. So with the huge study we've just published with the sea lions, the numbers really tell the story. And one of the things we found there is that all of the sea lions that have cancer all have the herpes virus and all have activated replicating herpes virus. Now, if you add in the contamination on top of that, you increase the probability of cancer from less than 20% with just the virus to, say, a low dose of chemicals, you increase it to 30%. And if you have a high dose of chemicals in the blubber of that animal, the chance of developing fatal cancer becomes 80%.
So, well, then the next question is, thinking about how the DDT is affecting other animals, what about the fish that is commonly eaten by humans?
Yes, and they also have these chemicals. And in fish that have been caught down in the California bite area, I read in some reports that tumors have been reported in them. So it's quite likely that that is associated with the exposure to the DDT and other chemicals in the sediments and in the area where they're living. And it's definitely known, too, in the Great Lakes. So we talked about the belugas, well, the Great Lakes draining to the St. Lawrence. But for decades, there's been a very high prevalence of tumors in freshwater fish in the Great Lakes area. So there's a definite connection between chemical pollution and tumors in various other vertebrates, not just mammals.
And then to think about aquaculture, I've been reading that a number of organizations are hoping to farm fish in mm-hmm. California waters in Southern California, right next to this area. And I'm sure that they're doing extensive research on this right now. What are your thoughts on that?
I'll tell you, I wouldn't eat it.
Well, I mean, people like Dr. Sylvia Earle basically say, leave the fish to the communities that rely on it, who can't live without it, you know, for their livelihood. Mm-hmm. Because this issue is really a global issue. I mean, when you add in overfishing and nets, and I mean, there's just so much.
There is. And there's definitely an argument for aquaculture because we have depleted the natural stocks of various species of fish, in some cases to the point of commercial extinction. And with the demand for protein and for fish, aquaculture certainly can fill that niche, but it needs to be done sensibly and in places where it's not going to cause environmental damage in its own right because of all the feed that's been used for these caged fish, et cetera, and the nitrogen, all the waste that the fish will put out in a local area. So that's a factor too, not to mention, as you said, what the fish may ingest from a contaminated environment if we're talking about Southern California. So there's just a lot of factors that need to be weighed up when these enterprises are undertaken and where they're sited, right, so that they are, you know, environmentally sustainable.
Today we are speaking with Dr. Parik Daignan, chief pathologist at the Marine Mammal Center, who is co-author of a new study that found cancer rates among adult California sea lions is significantly increased by their exposure to toxins in the environment, including DDT. We've done a number of shows about the LA Times report exposing the discovery of more than 500,000 DDT barrels that were dumped off of the Southern California coast near Catalina Island from the 40s to the 80s. Scientists say the dump site could be even larger than the city of San Francisco, According to the piece, one company, Montrose, caused a devastating environmental crisis. And this is a pre-taped Your Call, so unfortunately, we cannot take your comments, but we will definitely have Dr. Dagnan on a future show so we can open the lines. Where do you think the research needs to go from here? You said in the LA Times piece that researchers see the need to collaborate with more human oncologists to really focus on how this is affecting human health. Other doctors said the same thing.
Yes, indeed. And I would mention how sea lions could be a good model for certain cancers of people like cervical cancer, but also just the basic mechanisms of how cancer is initiated and how cancer cells propagate and then can transplant to other parts of the body and set up tumors in distant areas. So that process of metastasis is not well understood in any cancer model, including human cancers. And again, the sea lion could provide a good way to do that because we have animals, as I said, in various stages of development of cancer, from very early where it's limited to the reproductive tract right through where it's metastasized to the whole body. So the mechanisms, the mechanistic approach to studying tumorigenesis is something that we need to get more into. I've read a number of papers recently where looking at mechanisms of what happens at the cellular level are important in trying to understand cancers. And we talked earlier about the belugas, and a paper that was recently published by the team of researchers in Canada show that the PAH chemicals that were from the aluminum smelters bind directly to the DNA of cells in the gastrointestinal tract, and that's where the cancers in these animals mostly develop. So they were able to show direct binding of the PAH to the DNA, and it's called a DNA adduct. And they were able to definitely show that happening in the cancer cases. So that showed a link that in the past had just been an association. So they had high levels of the chemicals and they had the tumors, but all they could do was suppose that the two were linked. But now doing more mechanistic studies at the cellular level, they're able to show that, yes, in fact, the PAHs do impact on the DNA. Hmm. And there are similar studies by the Scripps Institute, too, that with organochlorines, these chemicals that occur off of Southern California, showing that they can interact at the cell level with drug transport receptors on mammalian cells and impede their ability to get rid of chemicals that would normally damage cells. So normally the cells have these transporters to get rid of these chemicals, but the organochlorine chemicals like DDT will bind to them and prevent them doing that. So those kind of mechanistic studies are something that are very important to do. Nothing like that's been done with the sea lion yet. So that's something that we could look at doing and find out if it's having the same effect at the cell level that is supposed that it happens or known to happen in human cells and with mouse cells, but we don't know about marine mammals.
Dr. Dagnan, in our seven or so remaining minutes, can we spend some time talking about what's happening with the whales, the dead whales that have been found in the San Francisco Bay? As of late May, there were 12. Is that still the case? 12 so far this year?
I think we're up to 13 now. So the mortality this year started on the 1st of April, and by the 8th of April, we already had four gray whales dead in the Bay Area, which outside of the big UME years, so 1999 and 2019, this is a very high level of mortality. And since that, then we've had several more gray whales and a fin whale, which is the second largest whale after the blue whale. And that's all been in the last 2 months. So it's been extremely busy period.
So what is going on here? The research team at the Marine Mammal Center points to entanglement, trauma from ship strikes, and malnutrition.
Yeah, those were the conclusions from the 2019 investigations. So this year, what we've seen is we had one whale in the Bay Area that definitely was severely malnourished, and that whale stranded on the Tiburon Peninsula. And unfortunately, we didn't have access to it where it stranded, so we couldn't do a full necropsy on that one. But of the other whales that we did get access to, most of them were in pretty good body condition. So there wasn't the same signs of malnutrition that we saw in 2019. And the whales that died within the bay were actively feeding. They had food in their stomach, like this, the kind of sediment you'd find at the bottom of San Francisco Bay with crabs and shrimps and all that kind of stuff in it. So they were actively feeding in good body condition, but they died suddenly. Now, we didn't necessarily find direct evidence of ship trauma, but something killed them suddenly. So the difficulty can be with a dead whale because they're so huge. And because wherever they lay on a beach, you can't really move them around anymore. You can't look at the underside to see if there's evidence of trauma on that side. So you're limited to examining the side that's exposed. So we didn't find direct evidence of ship trauma there, but there are other animals, like two that stranded just outside the Golden Gate, that definitely had ship trauma, which we recognize as fractured bones and severe muscle contusion and acute contusion that happened within minutes of the animal dying.
Mm. What explains the malnutrition?
Well, in 2019, when we had the sudden increase in mortality and a UME, or unusual mortality event, was declared by NOAA, quite a number of the whales that season, about one third of them, were in what we judged to be poor nutritional condition. Now, to understand that, you have to understand a little bit about the life history of the gray whale. So the gray whales are born in lagoons off of Baja, Mexico, and then travel with their mother north in the summertime, like May, April, May, up to Alaska. And that's where all the most of the feeding happens, in the Arctic waters off of Alaska. So they put on most of their body weight there. And then at the end of that season, like in the fall, early winter, they migrate south again back to Mexico. And during that whole migration south to Mexico, while they're in Mexico and going back up to Alaska, they really don't feed very much. They're relying on the food resources they laid down in Alaska. So we hypothesize that something had to be wrong in the Alaska environment for them not to have enough food heading south. And then by the time they were heading north again, they were running out of fuel. So to get a good handle on that, we had to look at what we knew about the physiology of the whales, about their normal blubber condition at different stages of the migration. And one of the things that we realized pretty quickly in 2019 was we actually don't know a lot about this. We really don't have a good handle on it. And judging what's in good condition, what's not, was rather quite subjective when we started talking to our colleagues up and down the coast, because with the unusual mortality event, we were then linked up with all the stranding networks from Southern California over Mexico right up to Canada and Alaska. And it turned out that everybody had a different opinion about what good condition was and what bad condition was. And what it prompted us to do was to really investigate this further. And we now have one of our staff members working on a master's degree looking into the condition of blubber at different stages of the migration cycle, so we can have a better handle on what's just normal fasting versus malnutrition and emaciation. Mm-hmm. But that level of emaciation, as I said, is not something we've seen much of this year. We had one case of it, and the rest were all in pretty good body condition.
Gosh, you think about these incredible creatures underwater, and they're being hit with so many things, the climate crisis and human activity. I mean, just seeing a turtle, you have to bow down, because what it takes for a turtle to survive all of this, and really all of the other creatures underwater.
Mm-hmm. Yes. We've definitely made the planet a very difficult place for anything other than humans to live in. And marine animals now in particular are being severely impacted by everything from the trash we dump in the ocean, the plastics, the ghost nets, and then all the chemicals that we've been talking about, everything from things you cannot see to the large things like the floating debris and stuff. We have definitely created huge problems for marine life.
Well, we're so lucky that there are people like you and your colleagues who really dedicate your work to saving these creatures. Can I just ask you, why are you so passionate about these issues?
I've always been passionate about the marine environment. I'm from Ireland, which is a tiny island surrounded by the Atlantic Ocean. So I've always been very focused on that and always interested in marine life. And I studied zoology and then followed that with my veterinary degree, specifically to study wildlife health and marine mammal health. That's always been my focus right from I can remember. So it's hard to pinpoint exactly where that started, but it's a long time ago. And I've just followed that through my career now. And at the Marine Mammal Center, I found a home that where everybody is passionate about the same goals, the same mission. And we're all striving to do our best to promote marine mammal health and conservation and ocean conservation in general.
Dr. Parik Daignan is chief pathologist at the Marine Mammal Center, an incredible organization that advances global ocean conservation through marine mammal rescue and rehabilitation. You can find more information about the study that Dr. Daignan was involved with, and you can find more information about the great work of the Marine Mammal Center. Dr. Daignan, thank you so much for your great work to you and your colleagues, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Rose. My pleasure to be here.
Thank you. And thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.